Hey everyone, it's Michael Ellsberg calling live from Brooklyn, New York, and I am so excited for tonight's call. We have live on the line Brian Franklin and Jennifer Russell. These are two people who are very, very near and dear to my heart for many reasons. Personally, Brian was the officiant at my wedding between me and Jenna almost 3 years ago in 2010. So this is a man that I trust very, very deeply. I trusted him to perform perhaps the most sacred ritual ceremony that I'll ever participate in for my life. That's how much I trust these people who are on the line. But specifically for business reasons, my trust in them started when about 4 years ago, I went to a free introduction that Brian was doing to a program he was doing. So it was like a free lecture, kind of like we were having tonight. And he gave some techniques about how to structure consulting arrangements and how to sell consulting arrangements and close deals on those kind of arrangements that I went in a sales call the next week. I went and I had only had sales retainers of about $300 or $400 a month. I went and used the techniques that he gave me in this free lecture, and I closed my first ever retainer of $5,000 a month. So that was quite a dramatic leap for me. This was about 4 years ago. And since then, I've used techniques that he's taught me to close retainers of $10,000 a month and more. So I owe a lot of my current financial comfort to these two people on the line. One more thing I'll say about that is that when I was studying with them more intensively as a student, I went into my studies with them basically as a wannabe author. I didn't have a book out yet. My first book came out during the time that I was studying with them. And then I got my first real big book deal for six figures for the Education of Millionaires, studying a lot of the techniques that they taught me about pitching and how to network and how to frame deals, and then went on to get my second six-figure book deal. So suffice it to say, these two people have had a massive outsized impact on my success, and I'm very excited if even just a bit of what they've taught me rubs off on you tonight over the next 90 minutes, it will be well worth all of our time. So, Brian and Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us here tonight.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Michael. It's a pleasure to speak to you and to your audience. Since this is one of the first opportunities to do so since your last book, I just want to congratulate you again on the success of The Education of Millionaires, all of the work that you did to make that such an important book for people who are looking at how can they educate themselves. And I still get people reaching out to us every month saying that they found us through that book and are big followers of you. And so I just wanted to congratulate you on your work.
Thank you, Brian. And for those of you listening, if you've read my book, you'll remember Brian is the first story in the introduction. So he opens my book. Brian is a proud non-college graduate who earns a lot more than most college graduates do. And also Brian and Jennifer's insights about the entrepreneurial mindset are the foundation for chapter 7 of that book. So we're going to dive right in right now. The topic of tonight's call is breaking through your revenue ceiling. So this implies that you already have revenue. This isn't necessarily a beginner call, like, how do I start a business? How do I figure out what I want to do in business? This call specifically is for people who are already in business, who have revenue coming in, but have found that you have a certain ceiling, that you just keep hitting up against this ceiling and can't seem to break through. And we're going to break through tonight. We're going to relentlessly figure out how you can break through the revenue ceiling. So, Brian, I want to dive right in. One of the biggest things you've told me that when you speak with people who have this problem, they say, well, I just don't have enough hours in the day. If I had 28 hours or 36 hours in the day, I could break through this problem. but I don't. So really what I need is a clone of myself to do, yeah. you know, double the work. But since I'm not a genetic engineer and I don't know how to clone myself, I'm basically fucked and I can't grow my business. So what do you say to people when they come to you with that problem?
So it's a couple of things about your revenue ceiling and I don't have enough time story. First is that your revenue, I want you to think about your revenue of the business as the byproduct of the game you're playing. So, just like sex or love, revenue is something that's really hard to actually go get if that's your objective. But if your objective is to create the maximum value for customers, then revenue becomes a normal kind of byproduct of that. So if revenue is the byproduct of the game you're playing, then how much revenue you're making is a function of what game you've decided to play. And people think that they decide to play what game, you know, they decide to play, they make the decision of what game they're going to play based on how much time they have. But we also know about the universal truth that every task fills the amount of time that you have allotted to do it. So if you have a week to write something, it'll take you a week. If you have a day, it'll take you a day. It's a year, it'll take you a year, right? And I'm sure you've experienced that. Since every task fills the amount of time you have, and we all have the same amount of time, it's really just a myth that we don't have time. The reason we're so busy and too busy to play a different game is that we're playing the one that's producing the revenue that we've got. So another way of saying this is, you are always winning the game that you're playing. You're always winning.
I like that. You're always – so that implies, in other words, that people are, whether consciously or not, setting themselves up for their current situation. And they could set themselves up for a different situation, but they're kind of unintentionally intending by various aspects of their psychology and – actions to be creating their current situation.
Yeah, and I just want to add, to put it even another way, is if you don't think you're winning, then you aren't playing the game you think you are.
Right.
Right? Many people will say, yes, I want to build $1 million business or $100 million business, and I'm losing that game. And it's not that you're losing that game, is that you're not actually playing the game you think you're playing. And so one of the things that we do when we work with entrepreneurs, when we see them hit up against their plateau, is discover the limitations and the factors that are defining the outside boundaries of the game they're actually playing.
Right.
And often when you're in it, you can't tell you've got clearly defined boundaries all around you that are forming that kind of ceiling.
I was talking with a woman who sold her business, and so she sold her business for, X millions of dollars, and then, but she was still working inside the business for the new parent company, and she had all the same problems that she had before she sold her business of not having any time, and she had these great strategic ideas about how to grow inside this new business, but she couldn't execute any of those ideas because she was spending all of her time making sure that her current customers were happy and doing fulfillment and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, Barack Obama and Richard Branson and Jennifer and me and Michael Ellsberg, we all have the same 24 hours in the day that you have. And, you know, they are able to accomplish a lot more and, you know, run the free world or 370 companies or whatever it is that Branson has now in the same amount of time that you're only able to take care of this one customer. So, and her response was, well, yeah, but that's because Branson has a team of awesome people that he can delegate to, and they know what they're doing, and the chief has the ideas, and he delegates them, and then they do it. And I said, well, how did he get those people? And she said, well, I don't know, that he maybe probably had enough time to go hire them. So, and it does, from the inside, you know, I'm making fun of her a little bit, but from the inside of your business, it does feel that way. It feels like you don't have any time. That's actually the accurate feeling. But it's because you've got certain commitments, games that you're playing, which are not actually in service to the game that you'd like to be playing, and you're committed to play those games, you're unwilling to stop playing them, and they are taking up the time that you would otherwise spend playing a game of, for example, creating a scalable team of experts who know what they're doing.
So Jennifer, what would be an example? Let's say someone wants to build, let's say someone has $1 million revenue business and they want to build a $10 million revenue business. That's a pretty common step that a lot of entrepreneurs have. And they're coming up against this revenue ceiling and they're feeling like they're losing the $10 million business game. What would you say is the game that they're winning? The current game, what you would point out and say, okay, well, you're losing that game, but this is the game you're now playing, which you're winning. What would be an example of that?
Yeah, well, I think I would take a look at the model for success that they're using, right? So, often we get into conversations with an entrepreneur. They've got their $1 million business that they're trying to build into $10 million business, and we look at the business model. Like, let's run some numbers here. If you maximized how much time you were spent fulfilling and looked at how automated and scalable your marketing is and how automated and scalable your sales are and how automated and scalable your fulfillment is, where does it max out? You know, where do you run up against a limitation whereby if you actually had more leads coming in or more sales coming in or more people to service, your current business would fall apart? And that maximum level, if everything was going perfectly, is that kind of ceiling or revenue ceiling that they're playing within. And so I usually when I'm working with someone is I look at that. You know, if for instance it's like a coaching business, right? And you're charging $500 a month for coaching clients. You know, a highly utilized coach is busy fulfilling maybe if they're working really hard 40% of the time. And so if you take 40% of however many hours you have in a month, and you multiply that by 500, you've got a pretty low revenue ceiling. So you're never going to get there if your model is charge $500, trade your time for money. And you've got that many hours. So something's got to change. You've got to look, your revenue ceiling under that model, as we get a calculator out, is about $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
So what you got to do is kind of look at that.
Yeah, and I've seen, Brian, I've seen you do this exercise I've happened to be lucky enough to sit in on a meeting that Brian had with a very high-level client of theirs that was running a fast growth business in the tens of millions of dollars of revenue range that was just growing head over heels, and the company was in chaos, and that's why Brian was brought in, and Brian had a meeting with about 10 people, senior management, and he said, okay, let's just imagine I have a magic wand here, and I wave the magic wand, and tomorrow double everything. Tomorrow double the leads come in, double the sales conversations, double the customers, double the customer service calls. What breaks? And he took out a big whiteboard, and essentially everything in the company break. I mean, they didn't have enough sales staff, they didn't have the training capacity for the sales staff, they didn't have enough customer service, they didn't have the procedures for the customer service, they didn't have the logistics in place to ship the products to that many people, and yet this was a company that was wanting to double. And do you remember that meeting, Brian?
I remember that meeting, yeah.
So is that that's what we're talking about here, basically, right?
That's exactly what we're talking about, yes.
Yeah, so that company needed, what Jennifer said, was a model for success. They needed to know about a business model or a different company, perhaps from a different industry or their own industry, that was double their size. And they had to look at structurally how's it different, and then what's the path of least resistance to build those structures and reduce the risk of building those structures, so you're not paying in advance for a bunch of stuff of need, so that as the company's natural impulse to grow occurs, you can follow that impulse. It can be buoyed up, and then that gives you the revenue to invest in the structures as they go. And that's how you top up past that ceiling of complexity. You can't win the game of $10 million business if you're winning the game of I do everything myself.
Right.
You can't win the game of I reached a $30 million marketing program which is highly targeted with new leads coming in, and also win the game of I do everything and I don't need to differentiate because I take such I have such personal care of my customers that they always know they can count on me. You can't win both at the same time.
Yeah. So we're 15 minutes in this call, and I would say this is already takeaway number one from the call. Everyone who's listening, is assume you may have the feeling that you're losing the game that you're trying to win, that you have some big goal, you're not reaching it, and you're losing that game. But what Brian and Jennifer are saying is assume you're already winning your current game. What game are you winning right now? So it may not be the game you want to play. It may not be the game that you ultimately want to win, but you currently have some model that is working for you. You're not, bursting into flames. You're not ending up, hopefully not ending up out on the street being kicked out of your home. So it's on some level, the game you're playing right now is working for you and you're winning it. So then the question becomes, is that the game you always want to win? Or is there another game that you want to win that's bigger? So here's my question for you both now is, I imagine there's many people listening on the call who are thinking, well, that sounds great, but it's like that old cliche, like I'm too busy hacking the tree to sharpen the saw. If they are winning that game, and let's say that, everything's basically just hanging together by a thread, which is how most entrepreneurs I know feel about their businesses, how do they then contemplate playing an entirely different game when they're, barely feel like they're keeping up with the one they're currently playing?
Go ahead.
Hello?
Okay. Well, we were looking at each other. We both wanted to talk both at the same time.
This is, by the way, all you listening, if you get to know Brian and Jennifer, this is a common occurrence. They're both like two crouching tigers who are like looking at each other, which one is going to pounce first.
Here's one of the things I'd like to say about the time issue, because it comes up a lot. I mean, we've all said that to ourselves. I don't have enough time. I'm too busy maintaining what is in my business, and I don't have the time to work on the things that would grow it, because I have to keep what structure I have alive, thriving before I can do anything else. I mean, that is one of the most common conversations I hear from entrepreneurs and people that are in their jobs that feel like they got stuck. And, one of the things that you might be surprised to hear us say is that usually we recommend that people look at not at like forcing themselves to do all sorts of things that are way outside of what they feel comfortable doing, and most of the people make a laundry list. Oh, I should be doing this. I should be doing that. I should be doing more SEO on my website, and I should be hiring more salespeople, and I should be getting on TV for my product or service. And there's all these lists of things that they should do, and the problem is with those lists is many of them are way outside what they feel good at, and mm-hmm. And so they never do it. They continue to sit on that kind of to-do list. And mm-hmm. So one of the things that we recommend to start with is to shrink wrap, as we would say, your commitments around things that you'll actually do, to begin there. Mm-hmm. So an example from Brian and I's business is, we decided we wanted to come out with a virtual program, and part of the virtual program was going to contain a whole bunch of videos. Videos of us teaching people about entrepreneurship, teaching them kind of the source code of success. And we got all excited about that, felt like a great idea. It is a good idea. It's like have a product, a way to scale our company and get in front of more people by offering them some of our wisdom kind of prepackaged in these videos. All that sounded great. Started the process. Started our first video. Took us not a few hours or even a day or two, but took us 6 days to do the first video. We hated it. It took forever. We didn't have anyone in front of us.
We promised to do one a week.
We promised one a week, and the first one took 6 days nonstop, like, all night.
Wow.
So you can see all these ideas sounded great, and yet this was obviously not workable if we had to come up with one of these once a week, and it took more than 6 days just to get it done. We had no time to do anything else during that week. So there we were in the exact situation you're talking about. And when I said, you know, the counterintuitive thing I want your audience to hear is to shrink wrap your commitments. And what I mean there is, okay, so what aspect of fulfilling on this product fits well in with what we're already good at, what we already like to do, what capitalizes on what gets us involved. Like, and what Brian and I discovered for us in this example is that it was really easy for us to show up, coach people that reached out to us. And the easiest way for us to develop all the content for our videos was to literally just have them tell us what they wanted to hear about, for us to record the call, and then all of a sudden we had all of these videos and all of this content. It was shrunk wrapped around things that we were already doing, and it made it easy for us. So what we knew about ourselves is that we tend to be more reactive, and we tend to be more inclined to do things that have other people involved, like a commitment to another human being. Some people work best alone, and some people work best if they have a commitment with another human being. And if you know which way you are, if you know which direction you tend to get more productive with, then you want to shrink wrap your commitments around some of those continuums. You know, for us, it's being in front of people. For us, it's committing to a public date, things like that. And so one of the ideas is to look at your business with a lot of honesty and look and shrink wrap those commitments.
Yeah, that's a great take. That's takeaway number two. You're, we're on a good roll here. We're only 20 minutes in this call. Takeaway number two, everyone, is shrink wrap your commitments to what you're actually going to do. So instead of making this big laundry list of all the stuff that would be nice to do to grow, you think you should do, be brutally honest about what you're actually likely to do and commit to those things. I think that's a great piece of advice, Jennifer. And I see one way that applies in my life. When I was first getting into social media, you hear all this stuff about, you know, you got to be on Twitter and you got to be on Facebook and you got to be on Pinterest and you got to be on Tumblr, and you know, there's 50 different things you have to be on. And
oh my God, I can't Tumblr? I didn't even know I had to be on Tumblr.
I got a list.
Put it on your, add it to your list. Like a lot of people, I got very overwhelmed, and I was thinking, wow, I barely even have time to keep up with my email. How am I going to do these 50 different social media things? Well, what I've evolved into is just doing one really well. And I'm really committed to Facebook, and I'm committed to doing Facebook well. And a lot of people tell me that they think I'm one of the more innovative people that they've seen on Facebook. But what that comes at a cost. It means I'm not hanging out on Twitter all the time, and I'm not hanging out on Pinterest and all these other things. But to use your language here, I've shrunk wrapped my commitments around what I actually am going to do for my growth. So I love that. Brian, you mentioned Brian?
Well, I was just going to say, you said, what do I do if I don't have time? And such a common experience. I think so many entrepreneurs feel like you're in a ping pong game for battling for your life. And you've got a bunch of ping pong balls flying at you in the form of customer requests and your business and, taxes and legal threats and all this stuff happens, and it's all coming in and all needs responses, and you're batting back these ping pong sometimes you have to dive across the table just to catch them. And
yeah.
then, and so you're playing this ping pong game, but if all you do all year is hit back all the balls that come at you reactively, then you're going to still be playing the same ping pong game.
Yeah.
But what we recommend is during your ping pong game, as you're batting these balls back, occasionally when a ball's coming at you, choose to not hit it. Choose to let it fall through the cracks. Choose to let that customer not sign up. Choose to not deal with that customer issue. Choose to just refund them and have them, you know, go home instead of trying to work it out. Choose to not do any social media at all for a month. And during the time, most people don't do that, by the way, until they're at their wit's end. And then
yeah.
they're at their wit's end, they choose not to do it, and then they zone out to try and recharge. Choose to not do that before you're at that breaking point, and then grab a brick and put it on the table and start to build a brick wall. If you keep grabbing bricks and putting them on that table in front of you, then pretty soon at the end of the year, you're going to have a 5-foot-tall brick wall that's batting back all of the ping pongs for you. And then you can only deal with the ones that are above a certain level, and now you're playing a bigger game. So you,
all right, that's takeaway number three. I think I'm hearing there, Brian, is choose to let some of the ping pong balls go by you, and instead build a brick wall that's going to bat some of them away.
Right.
And that's so hard for people who are dealing with various kinds of perfectionism and in their business. But that's the secret right there, everyone. If you don't have enough time, then you've got to just let some of the things you're currently committed to doing go by the wayside so that you can build the systems and structures that are going to get you out of just this reactive ping pong game that Brian described.
Yep.
Brian, I want to dive into another concept you mentioned. We've been talking about breaking through the revenue ceiling. Now, you mentioned a concept called the ceiling of complexity. Could you tell us what that means, the ceiling of complexity?
Yeah, sure.
This is a favorite of ours.
So I think I first heard this in an interview with Dan Sullivan and Joe Polish. They were talking about the ceiling of complexity that entrepreneurs have, which is basically as your business grows, it becomes more and more complex. And everyone has a degree of complexity that they can kind of intuitively manage. So, most entrepreneurs are operating at just above that level of things they can intuitively manage. But have you ever heard of the Peter Principle, Michael?
I have, yeah.
All right, this is great. So the Peter Principle, what's that?
No, yeah, go ahead. Tell our listeners what that is. Yeah.
Peter Principle says that everybody working in a large organization is promoted to one level above their competence, which means that everybody is incompetent at their job, which if you've ever worked in those places, you can kind of feel that sometimes. But it makes sense, right? You do a really good job as an entry-level guy, so they promote you to a manager. You do a really great job as a manager, they promote you to director. If you do a really great job as a director, they promote you to VP. But if you're not a good VP, then they stop promoting you. So all your VPs were good directors but bad VPs. All your directors were good managers but bad directors. So that's called the Peter Principle. And I think the same thing actually applies for entrepreneurs. Once we get good at a level of complexity in our business, the business promotes us. The business actually grows to just beyond the place where it can smoothly run at that level of complexity that we can manage, just given our, dexterity. And so our businesses have always grown one step beyond where we in our ceiling of complexity can manage them. And it requires actually doing sort of an internal surgery on yourself and external surgery on the business simultaneously to put in place the structures or relationships or habits, some of the things we've been talking about and some things we still have to say. You have to put those things in place that allow you as the entrepreneur to rise up and see things on a more global level. And, it's almost like if you're a dancer learning a dance routine. The first time you do a step, you have to manually figure out where's my foot go and am I twisting my ankle and I've got to rotate my arm at this one particular place and then I've got to have this direction looking with my neck. But then once you get each of those down individually, then it all comes together as one fluid, graceful motion, and then your brain doesn't have to keep track of all the parts anymore. And what you've done in that moment, if you've actually popped up to a new ceiling of complexity, and you can actually add more complexity in that moment, like a look in your eye or smiling or a flare or a finesse, you know what I mean, or doing something with your head,
right.
And you can add something. And the same thing's true in your business. So that's ceiling of complexity. And, again, the amount of complexity you can manage relates to the amount of value you can deliver, and then the revenue you have is just a byproduct of that value.
Yeah.
Now, my understanding – oh, go ahead, Jennifer.
So I was just going to reiterate for everyone. So your ceiling of complexity is the difference between what you can competently manage and what's required of you by playing a bigger game. And that ceiling of complexity is what separates you between those two things. The difference between what you can confidently manage and what is actually required of you by playing a bigger game.
Yeah.
Right?
And businesses are greedy. Whatever you can do, they're going to want more. It's because they have a natural internal growth instinct. Businesses are like children. They just grow. They're like weeds.
Yeah.
They grow and they grow and they grow. And so they will grow to one step beyond where you can handle them, and then they'll falter and park there, in some cases for decades.
So this is why almost every entrepreneur I know is, like, out of their minds crazy. Like, do you know any entrepreneur who's like, yeah, everything's pretty much calm, you know? Like, things are calm. I leave the office at 5. I have a relaxed dinner. Go to sleep early, get a good night's sleep, and get up for another day of smooth flowing the next day. Like, do you know a single entrepreneur who's like that? I don't.
Yeah.
And I think you've just nailed exactly why that's the case. Is that it always, even if you're a master entrepreneur? I mean, Richard Branson, you know, he's managing 370 companies. Could he manage 500? Could he manage 1,000? You know, at some point, everyone is at their ceiling of complexity.
Correct.
It's funny. We sometimes will talk about and refer to the Donald Trump syndrome. And, this will be a funny example of this, but Donald Trump has built up his empire into the billions and gone bankrupt and then rebuilt it to the same level and then gone bankrupt like 3 times over. He's filed for bankruptcy and built his empire up to about the same level every time.
Yeah.
And we meet entrepreneurs every day that, you know, basically, you know, your person starts a business, they reach a certain level of success, and then they sort of park there. And that, you know, even companies that appear to be growing are kind of standing still when you take into account the inflation, right? So you've got a lot more companies and entrepreneurs and businesses sitting there parking right at this kind of performance plateau or ceiling of complexity. And what we find is even people that build a company and end up leaving it or destroying it or starting over, 9 times out of 10, when they build their next company, they build it to about the same level every time.
And what I think is interesting is that they build it to that same level in half the time or less.
Yeah.
Every time.
Yeah.
So we have a client who's built 3 companies to about $500 million in valuation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the third company, well, the second company did it half the time as the first. Third company did it half the time as the second, or a quarter of the time of the first. So it's not that there's a downward pressure on the speed of growth. It is just a downward pressure on the ultimacy of how complex can it get before it needs to be popped out of his control before someone else can take it to grow. Exactly.
So let's cut to the chase then. How do you break through the ceiling of complexity? Every one of us has one. How do we break through it?
Yeah, even Donald Trump. Yes.
Even Donald Trump, even Richard Branson presumably
even Richard
has one. How do you break through it?
You know, when we're working with people, we look at 5 basic factors that build the walls that naturally determine your ceiling of complexity. And that any time that you're able to up your game radically, it coincides with you radically transforming in one or more of these 5 areas. So
tell us
let's just
what are they?
About what those 5 are. The first area is your structure, right? This builds the wall. Like, what is the model for success you're using, the structure of your business? The next wall of this of your ceiling of complexity is built by your personal habits, right? The third wall is built by your capabilities. The fourth wall is built by your relationships. And then the fifth wall is created by your behavioral and identity flexibility, like how flexible you are. And so your limitations are built by where you are with respect to your structures, your habits, your capabilities, your relationship, and your behavioral flexibility. So anytime you're wanting to break through, play a bigger game, get out of a current performance plateau, you need to look to one of these five areas and radically transform them. You transform your structure and you get way more leverage. If you transform your personal habits, you get broader execution. You transform your capabilities, you get better productivity. You transform your relationship and you get access to way more opportunities. You transfer your behavioral flexibility and identity flexibility, and you get greater influence. And so every time you break through, you want to break through your ceiling of complexity. We want to focus in on one of those five factors.
Let's talk about behavioral flexibility. That's
sure.
One that I happen to know a lot about, having studied with you guys. And I have stories about that one.
we remember.
But what does that mean for those who haven't had the chance to study with you yet? Because that's a key concept that you guys teach.
Yeah.
Well, there's a systems theory given, which is that the most flexible aspect of any system controls the system. Think about an electrical system with capacitors and switches and routers and things like this. Then the switch is the most flexible part of the system because it can either be on or off, and it controls the whole system. It can control whether the whole thing's on or off. Another example we always use is the classroom. You know, if you imagine the third grade classroom, the student who is throwing spitballs and writing notes and just doesn't care about the rules actually has the most behavioral flexibility in that room, and he's actually controlling the whole classroom. And
right.
The only way for the teacher to regain control is to actually have more behavioral flexibility than the student. You know, so if his teacher gets up and stands on her desk and screams and throws a fit or imitates him or crawls down on the floor in a fetal position and pretends to cry, then it'll silence that bully. It'll silence the whole classroom because the teacher is regaining control by exhibiting more behavioral flexibility. So just as taking that as a systems theory thing, and same with identity, you know, identity flexibility is your ability to decide, you know, this is me, this is not me. So the highest leverage thing that everyone on the call could do to grow their business, let's say from if they've been at $500,000 in revenue for year after year, to really put them on the path to $5 million for real, the highest level leverage thing they could do has occurred to them already dozens of times. And right behind that thought of what they should be doing comes the thought, well, that's not me, or I'm not really comfortable with that, or no, I don't think that might not work because that doesn't work in my industry. It's sort of like disqualifying good ideas, which based on models for success, which is a structural concept, based on model for success, we know that it works. And anytime there's a model of success that works, there's always an implementation which is consistent with your values and your brand. It is figure outable. It's a winnable game. But people don't try and play that game because they pre-decide that it's not them. And then they go back to some of the smaller tasks that are low leverage, which are really kind of hiding places for that routine behavior or that routine identity. And they do that because it makes them feel productive. And then at the end of the day, they go, wow, I'm too busy to really try anything new.
It sounds to me like you have some stories behind that one. I mean, you don't need to name names, what would be an example of a real life story that you've heard that someone kind of stays at their current level because they're not willing to, because they have that attitude of, oh, well, I don't do those things, when those things are the things that would have them grow to the next level.
Sure. I was talking to an entrepreneur today, in fact, this person has created a really successful business selling $30, $40, $50 info products on the internet. And they're quite good at that, right? That's actually a pretty hard game to play and win, and this person's winning that game for sure. And one of the things that we've noticed for that industry is that having a $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 upsell right on the back of a $20 product is working. In other words, it was conventional thinking that you needed to have a $20 product and then upsell to a $300 product and upsell to a $500 and keep going like that. But some brave soul tried going from a $20 product upselling to an $8,000 product, and it actually worked. And so we were talking about just experimenting with that and creating a high-touch product, essentially offering coaching or offering consulting on the back end for a very high dollar. And then if it was successful, we said, then you can find other coaches to do the work for you, and you might only have to do one or two yourself. And the response was, oh, well, that's not really me. That seems like a lot of time commitment. I can't do it. There's no way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're happy to spend hundreds and hundreds of hours trying to finesse the landing page for the $20 product. But the idea of spending 3 or 4 hours talking on the phone with a customer who paid you $8,000 felt like it was too much of a commitment. And that, to me, represents an inflexibility in identity or an inflexibility behaviorally. Oh, I don't do that. That's uncomfortable for me. I'm not sure. You know.
And so he was really boxed in to, no. All I do is sell info products online. I'm not going to do this high-touch coaching thing. Even though he started with us saying, hey, I really want to make a lot more income, and I want to do it the fastest and easiest way possible. But presented with that, his inflexibility is going to hold him back and hold him within his current level, because no matter how much tweaking he does to his sales pages, that's only going to be an incremental difference, not an exponential difference.
And not a game changer.
Right? So, he might get a couple points more on conversions for his offer. And we, of course, encouraged him to do that and gave him lots of ideas for how to do that better. But it isn't a game changer.
But he's in a position where if tweaked, he could be selling several hundred packages at $8,000 each every month.
He easily put him into the seven-figure business range.
Yeah,
seven or eight-figure business range, yeah. Immediately, exactly.
So it's this distinction between incremental changes versus game-changing changes. And, you know, if you're look at yourself honestly and look at most of the time you're spending, most of it is probably on incremental changes. And you probably feel very snowed under by all the work you're doing on the incremental changes. So what I hear Brian and Jennifer saying is you've got to give up some incremental changes. Would you give up, 5 or 10% change so that you could have 100% change? That's a question you should entertain. Jennifer, now you've talked about how you've listed these five different areas that can lead to ceilings of complexity and ceilings of revenue, issues with people's work habits, their business relationships, the structure of their business, and then we talked about behavioral flexibility. There was one more, wasn't there? What was the other one?
Yeah, increasing your capabilities.
Right. Oh, okay, so that's like skills and capabilities, right?
Yeah.
So now you've talked about, Jennifer, how a lot of people, their instinct is to lead with their strengths. So let's say they have a business that has really been built on their capabilities. You see this a lot in tech. You see, a lot of guys, the kind of person I'm talking about tends to be guys, so I'll just say that. Like, you see a lot of guys with incredible technical skills, and that's gotten them very far in business. And so they figure, well, if I just hire some more technical skills, if I hire some more people with technical skills, Or if I increase mine and maybe get a PhD or a second PhD or something like that, well, then this has gotten us this far. That's going to double our business. But meanwhile, you meet the guy at a cocktail party and, like, you feel, like, viscerally nervous talking around him because he's so fidgety and can't look you in the eye and can't shake your hand. And it's like if the guy took a, like, you know, a $200 Dale Carnegie course on how to, you know, how to make small talk, he'd probably double his business. You know, so
yeah,
you talk about basically people should lead with, try to break through the ceiling complexity with their weaknesses, not their strengths. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I'd love to tell you more about that because I love talking about points that feel either slightly controversial or counterintuitive. You know, everybody on the planet will tell you, play to your strengths, play to your strengths. And for making incremental differences, adding on to an already developed strength is not a bad idea. But if you're wanting to literally break out of your own ceiling of complexity, by very definition, it's about making a radical shift in an area that is currently underdeveloped. And, you know, often a very small difference in, for instance, in your example, your technical guy's capability to build relationships, like a 5% difference in his ability to connect with people and create more relationships would have a much bigger impact than him learning the next coding coming out of the PHP forum that has him know how to do one more trick or 10 more tricks and him getting another techie guy to help him kind of tweak the features of his software product, for instance, right? Now, all of that being said, that'll make, you know, an incremental difference. It might add a nice cool bell and whistle to what he's offering. But a small, like him developing one key relationship could change the entire face of his business. And that's his flat side. That's going to create the radical shift. That's going to break you out of your ceiling of complexity. So, you know, when you're listening to us and we're saying here are the five factors, I kind of want all of you guys to look at, you know, your structures, your personal habits, your capabilities, your relationships, and your behavioral and identity flexibility, and look at the one where if you made a tiny, small difference in your ability in that area, you know, what would be the highest leverage change you could see in your business? Which one of those areas could you focus a little bit on? You know, and in around stuff like that, you don't need to know how to do everything. You know, but, you know, often when you're trying to help people pass this, if you can find the right mentors, the right, you know, partners, and be in a community of people that have them, like be in a community of people that know how to create relationships, that have the capabilities you're looking for, that have the habits that you want to be having, by you know, associating yourself into those communities, that's the best way that we know of to break through your ceiling of complexity.
You guys you're probably familiar, Michael, with the studies that say, and you know, now Discover Your Strengths is an example of the research, this kind of research. Studies that say that you can actually do better in business if you focus on your strengths and if you focus on your weaknesses, right?
That's the wisdom, the conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
But what I want to point out is there's an assumption in the study, which is that you're working in a specialized system, meaning that you are the director of sales, and somewhere else there's a director of marketing, and somewhere else there's a director of engineering, and somewhere else there's a director of operations. But as an entrepreneur, even if you have a team of 20, you are still the thought leader in all those domains. You're still it. You know, the entrepreneur is the one who is giving life to all aspects of the business. You know, once you get to a team of 100, we could argue that, you know, you're starting to get into some meaningful specialization. But if you have a team of 5 or a team of 8 or a team of 3, you're it. And that means that you can only get to the next level past that ceiling of complexity if you have the minimum competency across every area. It doesn't mean that you need to be just as good at people skills as you are behind the computer, or that you have to be just as good as a marketer as you are a salesperson, or just as good at at the, you know, selling in a teleseminar as you are selling one-on-one in person. It does, however, mean that you have to just make that small change, that incremental, smallest, raise the minimum, raise the lowest common denominator across the board, not only for yourself, but signal to the contractors and everybody that works around your business that the level of competency and expertise that's required here is at that next level, and that will pop you up to the next level of complexity. I can almost hear it when we do it in our business, there's like this popping sound. You know, when we just tweak that last personal habit, you know, like, okay, you know what? It used to take us 5 days to get back to people on phone and email. We've now put in place the personal habits where it's never more than 24 hours, and bam, you hear this popping sound, and it unleashes another 200,000-300,000 in revenue. So that's you know, that I just wanted to tie together that research of Now Discover Your Strengths and what we're talking about and why those two can coexist.
That's a great contrarian advice, because that's a, you know, that book is kind of a Bible to a lot of people. And here, yeah, you know, here you are saying that actually the opposite is the case. I want to dive into, there's one other topic I promised everyone we would get into in the description I wrote for this call. And that is, the idea, Brian, you had a quote in the copy that I shared with everyone where you said, you don't need more time. What you actually need is a better understanding of how and where you provide value to your business. It's only because you don't quite understand how that works that it occurs to you like you need more time. There is a way out of this time quandary, and it's the same way every time. It's by getting clear on how you provide value as a leader in your business. So could you tell us, what does that mean to be clear on how you provide value? People are clear how they provide value to their customers, but what does that mean to be clear on how you provide value to your own business?
Well, you know, I'm sure everyone on the call is familiar with the experience of, well, I have to do this myself. If I want it done right, I've got to do it myself. And that experience, that thought is actually the mother and father to the experience of being stuck where you are, of wanting to be able to replicate yourself but not being able to do it, of not having enough time. Mm-hmm. If you trace that back, it starts with, if it's going to be done right, I have to do it myself. And the reason why you think you have to do it yourself is that you don't understand exactly how you're doing it, that it's being done well. You only can see a portion of what makes you good at it. And so you are looking to hire or outsource or delegate that portion which you can see. And if you're really good, you find someone else who's good at that same thing, and you give the task to them. But you don't give just the portion of the task. You give the whole task to them, including the parts that you were good at and didn't see how you were solving the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's baffling to you that this smart person who's supposed to be capable, and they have a resume and they had references, and why is it that they can't do the simple thing and get it done right the way that you can do it? Well, it's not that they are ignorant and can't get it done. It's that you are ignorant of exactly what is going into making it work. So if you start to examine what are the things that you're doing that are holding the business back, and what are you doing that's propelling the business forward, and start segmenting them into very small bits, and delegating the parts that are making it work to other people who can make that work.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to be a carbon copy of you, which is always why it feels like you'd have to hire six people to replace you. Everybody feels that way. They feel like they'd have to hire six of you to replace them. So it's because we're all like this unique snowflake shape, right? We're not all copies of each other. And so when you're delegating, you need to delegate the part of it you understand to the part of them that you understand can do it. And then give them enough freedom to grow in the role to start to do the things that they are naturally good at that you can't do, and allow the role itself to grow and provide value to the business shaped to their unique contribution. And if you can do that, then you start to be buoyed by your team. You start to have 5 or 6 people under you, or 20 people, or 100 people under you, who are all themselves self-expressed in their business, in their roles. They're charged up, and they've created this unique way of providing value to the business, either through marketing, getting leads, sales, or through fulfillment. You know, that whole channel of that cycle of value providing value to the customer. So that's the I guess that's the answer to that question. That the more you can distinguish how you're providing value, the more effectively you can delegate. And if you haven't done that, then it's, you know, if you don't know what value you provide customers, you can't market. And if you don't know what value you provide business, you can't hire.
And I'd like to make one statement, even one level beyond what Brian just said, which is if you think you can't delegate some aspect of your business, like it has to involve you, it's actually not an indication that that step involves you. It's that you don't understand it well enough. Because every business that scales, you need to be able to delegate and have even a monkey do it, right? That's when you know you understand it. When you can have almost anyone take on an aspect of your business that you could delegate, you fully understand it. So anything you're telling yourself, I can't delegate this, is an area of your business you don't fully understand yet. And so notice where you're saying that to yourself.
So if we think about all the things we talked about tonight, all of the things adding up to what's creating your ceiling of complexity, how it is now, and all of the different ways we gave you advice on how to peek into expanding beyond that ceiling, you know, whether it's changing your personal habits or relationships or capabilities. To me, it actually, the whole thing points to a underlying problem. There's actually a problem, in my view, in the culture of entrepreneurship, which it's a belief that we all kind of drank. It's not something we even really believe in ourselves. We all drank this belief like Kool-Aid. And because of that belief, it's causing an inability for us as a culture of entrepreneurs to continually go beyond our ceiling of complexity. And I think without this belief, this call would be of no interest. And that belief is that fundamentally entrepreneurs have to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally, you know, if you make a picture of an entrepreneur, they're the one alone in the mountain conquering the world. And sure, they have a team of support, you know, a team, quote, under them, unquote. But when I think, you know, when you think of the word entrepreneur, the brand of an entrepreneur doesn't support having a lot of peers.
Yeah.
And that is actually the problem, because none of the things that we mentioned, not personal habits, not capabilities, not the structures, you know, the models for success and really understanding them, not figuring out, well, how much is enough of capability in this one area? You know, what's the minimum, in fact? Is it here or is it here? Not your behavioral flexibility and, of course, relationships. All of that can't actually be accurately viewed, accurately assessed in a vacuum. I mean, it's obvious.
Yeah.
You can't yourself, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's something that we've realized. It's that's total myth. It's not true that entrepreneurs do it alone. In fact, when you look at the entrepreneurs who have been successful, none of them did it alone.
Yeah.
No entrepreneur who ever built anything that was worth building did it themselves. And yet we have this weird idea that we have to do it ourselves. So Jennifer and I have been spending the last several years kind of building, not to get biblical on you, but Noah's Ark for entrepreneurs, where we can all be in it together. And in doing so, something magical happens. You know, the solution isn't just to get together. But you know how if you're committed to the success of your customer rather than committed to you getting the deal, something
like closing the sale.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
When you make a shift of commitment to other, when you're committed to the customer's value instead of committed to growing your business, something magical happens. You get better ideas.
Yeah.
It all flows. Well,
yeah.
At the next level of complexity up, the same thing is true of entrepreneurs. When entrepreneurs come together in community and get committed to the future that all of them envision to happen, when they get committed to each other's success, when they get committed to contribute the most and share the most with each other, then their own ceilings of complexity just blow up. I've never seen anything like how fast people can grow into the next iteration of their business and how fast companies can scale.
Let's continue offering some time. We've got some interesting questions that have come in, and we'll round out the rest of this call with those questions. Here's an interesting one. This is from Keith in Houston, and Keith asks, my wife and I are business partners. Do we do the five factors together or separately? In other words, let's say, you know, do they each need to look at which five of the five factors they have to break through, or they, can they kind of divvy up as business partners?
That's an awesome question. First of all, kudos for kudos for working together. You know, as Jennifer and I do, I just think it's the neatest thing when you can work with your loved one, because once you get over, like, you know, trying to compete with your spouse and just actually make it work together, which for Jennifer and I was easy because each of us are convinced that the other one has the better end of the deal. But the once you can sort that out, then you just get to spend all your time with people you care about most. So first of all, kudos. I'd say you can specialize. However, I know that there were certain personal habits of mine that were holding Jennifer back. And I know that there were certain aspects of, you know, Jennifer's leadership that were holding me back. And it wasn't until we were willing to team up together where I not only where I'll cover this and you cover that and specialize, but where, you know, we set aside some time. So I'm like, okay, Jennifer, where am I holding you back? Where do I need to actually raise the minimum bar, the minimum side of the wall, so that collectively our ceiling of complexity can raise up? And she's willing to do the same with me. So then it's like, look, you know, I don't mind that you don't do this. I don't mind you don't do that. We can specialize. But this one thing needs to improve because it's hurting us both. And, you know, with a married couple, you have to make sure you create the space where it doesn't become a personal thing, because we tend to be really sensitive to feedback with our partners. The most horrible thing in the world you could tell me is that I somehow – let Jennifer down. I, you know, it's like I have immediately have suicidal thoughts. So, so you know, when she's giving me feedback, she has to do it in a tender way. We have to create a little space for that, and vice versa.
Great. Thank you so much. That's great. Let's get to a few more questions here. Let's see here. Cheval from Huntsville asks, how do you get to the mindset of creating value rather than the mindset of money that so many people are caught in? How do you switch from trying to create value rather than creating money?
Yeah, I think it begins with putting your focus on helping someone outside of yourself, helping your customer. You know, If you're focused on, I mean, just notice where your attention is when you are looking at your business and when you're providing your products and services. Is your attention on how do I get that next conversion? How do I use the next marketing tactic to get me more leads? Or is your attention on how do I create more value? How do I have the success stories of my customers increase and increase? You know, we were at a marketing conference and it was a whole bunch of people that were coming, and they were thought leaders, and they all had like seven-figure businesses and were doing really well, and were teaching people the tricks of the trade, like how do you get more people to come to your website, and how do you get more people to sign up for your upsell. And they were giving all of these strategies and tactics, and people were taking serious notes. And then Dean Graziosi walked up in front of the room, and you know, he had a $100 million business or more, and his talk was altogether different. What he said is, look, I don't focus at all on what my conversions are and, you know, how many sales I'm making and even what my revenue is. I measure my success by the success stories of my customers. Like, and so I've gotten really good at figuring out how to increase those, and so that's my metric. So what I would tell her or him, Cheval, I can't tell, is to focus on a metric that has to do with the success and value you're creating with your customers, and use that. You know, count up those stories, look at those testimonials.
Also, depending on your business, if you're removed from the point in time when your customer actually experiences value from your service and product, then arrange to be in contact with that. You know, one of the most motivating things you can do for software companies and engineers is to have them sit side by side with users and watch the users use the software. Because when you as a designer or as the entrepreneur can see your customer actually receive benefit, then and you feel the joy of them actually getting the benefit, that's the thing to remember. That is the quote value that you're honing in on, that you're trying to maximize. And then that moment when you're feeling like, what about me, and I'm afraid about money, and I got to pay my bill, if you just get quiet, remember that moment when you actually witnessed the customer get value, that's what's important. And if you focus on that, the bill will take care of themselves.
Wonderful.
Do we have time for one more?
Yeah, we have time for one more here. This is a slightly detailed question, but I actually have the exact same question. So probably if two of us are having it, more have it. When you talk about being clear on providing value in your own business, Evans from Malaysia, I have no idea what time it is in Malaysia, but he's on the line from across the world, says,
right.
Does this translate to literally outsourcing only portions of tasks while doing the parts where you perform magically yourself? In other words, you were saying, you know, the reason it's hard to outsource is that you don't understand. So,
yes.
So does that mean you then only outsource parts of it once you understand how it works?
Initially, yes. And then, you know, first of all, anytime you outsource something you don't understand, it's going to be disaster. They're not going to get it right. You're going to be frustrated. You're going to think that they're not good at their jobs, which is really funny. Anytime you think that the contractor is not good at their job, it's because you didn't understand the task you asked them to do. Always a flipperoo on that one. But so initially, yeah, you just ask them to do the parts that you do understand, and you do the stuff that only you can do that's magic. And meanwhile, get committed to understanding it. You know, continue to study it, and over time it will reveal itself to you. And then the more it reveals itself to you, the more you can outsource or delegate until finally you have a team doing it.
Yeah, you need to know enough about what you're delegating to select the right partners, contractors, employees to delegate to. So make sure
yeah.
that whatever you're delegating. The problem is that a lot of early entrepreneurs think, oh, I don't understand how to get more business grow some new into some new industry. Let me go and hire somebody that can help me do that. And the problem is that if you haven't figured it out in your own business with your own nuances, you know, you probably don't know how to do it enough to pick the right person as a partner to outsource to. So some of what we recommend is understanding it well enough such that you have the capability to delegate well. Because a lot of that stuff crashes and burns. We've seen so many times entrepreneurs try to scale their business. They add a bunch of hires. They hire incorrectly, and it costs them, you know, lots and lots of money. So you've really got to know what you're outsourcing before you outsource it.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't understand marketing, so I'm going to hire someone to do it for me. And I don't know about you, Michael. I've just never seen that work.
I've never seen that work. Because here's why that doesn't work. I've seen this again and again. You know, I don't understand copywriting, so I'm going to just hire a copywriter. I don't understand, you know, web design, so I'm just going to hire a web designer. Well, it's great if you hire a copywriter and a web designer, but you've got to understand the basics of what you want. And this is why, because there's any activity, there's at least somewhere between 5 and 10 different philosophies on how to do that. So just take my expertise, which is copywriting. There's so many different kinds of copywriting. There's hard sells, there's soft sells, there's, you know, relationship-based, there's story-based, there's really aggressive fear-based. And I've seen this blow up, I mean seriously blow up, in a thought leader who was very well known for kind of talking about relationship-based business and building long-term relationships with customers, didn't understand copywriting. Hired a copywriter, thought, oh, well, I don't understand copywriting. I should hire a copywriter. You know, I don't know if you found the first copywriter in the phone book or just got
yeah, right.
You know, the first referral that came his way. But whoever he hired was a hard sell, fear-based copywriter. And so this guy who's all based on, like, building relationships has this copy go out that's like, if you don't buy in the next 24 hours, you're going to die, basically, you know, like that kind of copy. And, like, the guy actually had to write an apology to his entire list. He got so many complaints, he had to write an apology to his entire list saying, I'm sorry, I didn't understand copywriting enough, and I hired the wrong person, and it won't happen again. So, you know, and that can happen in every area of your business. It doesn't mean you need to be a master copywriter, but you at least need to know what the schools of thought are for whatever the field is, whether it's programming or sales or copywriting or customer service or whatever that may be. Brian and Jennifer, thank you so much for taking the time.
Let's tell people one more time how to reach us.
Yeah, exactly. I was just about to do that. And I also want to just summarize for everyone the main takeaways tonight. Before I summarize, just for those who do want to speak with Brian and Jennifer, the URL is mind, money, meaning, no and, but just those three words together, mindmoneymeaning.com/Ellsberg, ELLSBERG. And you can sign up there to experience your own consultation with Brian and Jennifer one-on-one.
Yeah,
so everyone, just to rehash, we got a lot of takeaways on this call, and I took some notes. I want to remind all of you what they were. The first takeaway right off the bat was the idea that you're already winning whatever game you're playing. So it's not like you're losing the game. You're just choosing to play this current game, which you're winning at. So which game do you want to play that's bigger? The second takeaway was to shrink wrap your commitments around what you're actually going to do. So instead of making a laundry list of ways to grow your business, shrink wrap what you commit to the ones you actually know based on an honest reckoning with yourself you're actually going to do. The third takeaway was to actually choose to drop some balls, which will buy you time to stop being in this reactive ball hitting game. So choose to drop some balls, which will buy you time to then create structures where you're not just running around catching balls. The fourth takeaway was about breaking through the ceiling of complexity, and we learned about the five pieces of the ceiling of complexity: your habits, your work habits, your business relationships, your behavioral flexibility, and identity flexibility. How you see yourself in business, and how flexible you are in whether you're willing to change how you see yourself in business, the structures you have in place, business structures, and your skills. And then that led to our most counterintuitive takeaway for the evening, which was not to lead with your strengths, as all the management books say, but to break through that ceiling of complexity with your weakness, because that's your weakest link that's holding you back. So whatever area of those five you're weakest in, that's the one you need to focus on to break through the ceiling of complexity. And the sixth takeaway was not to go at it alone. You know, to build, however you're going to do it, build a tribe of other entrepreneurs who are doing the same thing, not the same business, but in the same position that you're in as an entrepreneur, to support each other. So thank you both so much for your insight, and we all really appreciate it, and just thank you.
Thank you, Michael. It's really fun to do this, and I'm really pleased to reach out to your listeners, your following that you've been carefully building, and building that wonderful relationship with Facebook and your book. So happy to help you give benefit to them, and hopefully this call, I mean, this takeaway sounded awesome to me, so hopefully this call really can help people think about things differently.
Great. Yeah, it was such a pleasure. Cool. Thank you for having us.
Good night, you too. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Bye, everyone.
Good night.